Hello everyone, this is Marissa DeMaia with the Southwest ADA Center. I will be serving as moderator for today's session. Today's program is brought to you as a collaborative effort between the Great Lakes and Southwest ADA Centers, members of the ADA National Network. This session is offered as part of the ongoing ADA Legal Webinar Series. Our session today is being recorded, and that recording will be available for review within about 24 hours of the conclusion of this session. A copy of the PowerPoint presentation for today's session was available for downloading prior to the start of the session. If you were not able to access that ahead of time, you will be able to access that and the materials, I believe there was a handout, via the archive for this session, and a link will be posted at http://www.ada-audio.org/. Within about 24 hours following the conclusion of today's session. Our presenter today will provide us with some valuable information, and at the conclusion of the presentation, there will be an opportunity for everyone to ask questions. Please follow the instructions provided for submitting your questions to our presenter. Now, you won't be able to view the questions as they're submitted, but they will be viewable to me as your moderator and our presenter. Again, we will address those questions at the end of the session, so feel free to submit them as they come to your mind during the presentation. I'm going to begin today's session by introducing our presenter, Aaron McCullough. For those of you who may not be familiar, Aaron is an attorney and ADA consultant through his company, ADA Consult. He's also a member of the Disability Issues Committee of the State Bar of Texas. And you can read a little bit more about Aaron by accessing his posted bio on the website at www.ada-audio.org/webinar/ADA legal/. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Aaron for the presentation. Aaron?
Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Well, good. Well, I want to correct one thing. I am not a member of the Disability Issues Committee of the State Board of Texas. I am a former member. But I served my time on the board, hopefully with distinction, but I not only timed out, but I did move out of the state. So I don't want anybody crowing about accomplishments that I don't presently own. But I also do want to thank the Southwest ADA Center, the Great Lakes ADA Center, and the entirety of the network of ADA centers for giving me this opportunity to present on kind of a niche pet topic of mine about the boundaries of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so I do thank your indulgence, and for anybody who's participating out there, I hope that that you weren't turned off by the kind of scattered notion of this presentation, that you're as excited as I am about finding out maybe some new things about the ADA. And again, that was part of the goal. I do want to talk a little bit about the origin of my interest this way. I attend far many more continuing education sessions than I present in a given year, and I attended one presented by a really good Houston lawyer by the name of James Passamano, a partner in the law firm of Sufium and Passamano, and an issue came up of the application of civil rights laws outside the territorial United States, and it kind of fired my interest up in these more fantastic applications of civil rights laws generally and the Americans with Disabilities Act specifically, and that's kind of the origin. So for purposes of the next hour and a half, what we're going to be discussing is what the Americans with Disabilities Act is, but as often as not, what the Americans with Disabilities Act isn't. The formatting apparently blew that out. That's supposed to be making that clear. But in any case, Moving forward, understand that we're going to be talking about the envelope issues, pushing the envelope issues of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the confines, the boundaries, the gray areas, and places where you might expect that the ADA would extend protections for people with disabilities, but in fact is not. In some areas that I think you may be surprised that the ADA or related law offers protections where you thought it might not. So if that's sufficiently vague, we will move forward with the content. I also provided a handout in lieu of more formal materials. It's an annotated list of links for some resource materials and reference materials that I used in the preparation for this, and some things that I figured would be useful if anybody was as geeky as I am and wanted an opportunity to follow up in more detail on content that we cover. I encourage anybody who is interested to please download that. To the extent feasible, I use materials that were created by the ADA centers or vetted by various federal agencies. Where not, I certainly have detailed what that is. Understand none of this is intended to be the final word on a particular legal issue, but could maybe help you move along towards your understanding. So again, I encourage you to download that wherever that lives. In addition, as I move along, I'll try to indicate where through a citation where whether or not that's an issue that's dealt with in more detail and is available for further exploration in that handout. The next slide, I want to make this abundantly clear. I think that there's a great deal of anxiety about the Americans with Disabilities Act from entities that are obliged to comply with it, a great deal of anxiety about the what people's rights with disabilities are under the Americans with Disabilities Act, because unquestionably it is a complex and technical set of laws. I want to make it clear that, and I'm serious about this, I don't blame you for not understanding the Americans with Disabilities Act in its entirety. I don't blame those who are obliged to follow the ADA for every failing of the law in its application to, for example, the city that you work for, or the state agency that you may work for. I don't blame you. You are not to blame for every failing in the last near 25 years. But moving forward, you're at least should be held responsible. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And open your eyes to the notion that perhaps there's more that you can do. So I forgive you. I'm not entirely sure that the advocacy community does. Okay, I think just a little bit of for a little bit of background, let's explore who's covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Think of it this way. Who's protected under the ADA? The ADA protects people with disabilities from discrimination in a variety of arenas. In addition, it may protect somebody who's affiliated with a person with a disability under certain circumstances. And it certainly protects, for example, coworkers who may participate in the lawful EEO activities of a coworker with a disability who's putting forward a claim of workplace discrimination. And so, for example, if a coworker was asked to was deposed as part of a lawsuit of claimed workplace discrimination, and an employer in fact discriminated against that coworker without a disability for their role in that lawsuit, then they would be protected under the anti-retaliation provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act. But just to keep it simple, the Americans with Disabilities Act protects people with disabilities. Who's obligated under the ADA? The Americans with Disabilities Act obligates employers, it obligates state and local governmental entities, and it obligates places of public accommodations or businesses and commercial facilities that are open to the public. That's a pretty skeletal outline of the arenas of protection of the ADA, but I think as I allow this to unfold, I think you'll understand why I wanted to refresh that. So this entire presentation deals with thresholds or boundaries or where the ADA sidewalk ends, as the tongue-in-cheek title suggests. Again, my motivation was to explore the how far you can take the ADA and where the ADA doesn't reach. And there's some specific legal constructions that we'll discuss along the way of what is protected under the ADA, what arenas are protected. And I think the best place to start is really at the beginning. Now, I want to encourage you this is the point where I'll reference the handout. I would encourage you that if you're uber nerdy like me, to check out the NCD paper that I think is the first citation in the handout, or the National Council on Disabilities. They have a paper titled The Equality of Opportunity, The Making of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I encourage anyone to read it when you have a chance, discussing the, I guess, the historical and political background towards the passage of the Americans, around the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. There are a scant few good writings on the history of this, you know, very important civil rights laws, and this is one of them, and I provided a link to it. And it discusses some of these issues that we're going to deal with in the next several slides in a lot more detail than the time would allow us here. So there are some ADA definitional limits that I think, again, are vitally important. You can meet the definition of a disability under the ADA, and most of you all know this, by establishing one of either three tests, what we call the prongs of the ADA definition. So the first is that you have a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major bodily functions or major life activities. Two, that you have a record of such an impairment. Or three, that there was discrimination based on a perceived or actual impairment that is not both transitory and minor. And we're going to discuss that in detail. So in this third prong, a person can qualify by showing that they are regarded as a person with a disability by being subjected to an act that's prohibited under the ADA Amendments Act. So essentially that they're discriminated against on the basis of a perception that they are a person with a disability who would otherwise be covered under the ADA. In addition, that creates a situational or definitional limit itself. So as the graphic here illustrates, it is possible to have an impairment that falls short in some way of a disability as it's defined under the Americans with Disabilities Act and as it's protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So there's a whole host of diagnoses and things that in common parlance we would consider to be an impairment of some sort, a psychiatric or a physical impairment, but nevertheless might fall outside the protections of the definition of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And we're going to, again, talk about that in a little more detail. In addition, there's some specific diagnoses, for lack of a better word, that are excluded or conditions that are excluded by statute. But I want to hit upon this point of what transitory or minor impairments. Before the Americans with Disabilities Act, or before the ADA Amendments Act, we kind of had a rule of thumb with regards to the nature of an impairment moving towards a disability, and we discussed it based on some EEOC guidance, and we threw out the notion of this kind of a definition. I may break my leg, and it may be a very severe impairment, and in fact, it may significantly impair me over a fairly long period of time. But if the prognosis was that I should expect a full or near full recovery and not be after that recovery impaired under the impaired by that injury, then I wouldn't be considered a person with a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And you can kind of see that sounds pretty good black letter law, but could create some situations where there would be a potential for substantial discrimination against somebody who in all but an arbitrary set an arbitrary duration is in fact a person with a disability, and then who is discriminated against, for example, in a workplace setting. It's very clear that Congress didn't intend to cover every illness, every diagnosis, every circumstance where someone isn't at their optimal physical or emotional health. So a condition such as having a cold isn't the type of impairment that Congress intended. It's a little less clear as we slide down the continuum of duration and expected prognosis where something truly becomes transitory, a transitory and minor impairment that falls outside the definition of the ADA. And I think the regulations actually reference if it's a minor impairment, it's not going to fall out. If it's transitory, we tend to think of this as the expected prognosis is like a 6-month period. And I say that's sufficiently vague because there's some circumstances where the EEO has shown a willingness to litigate in situations where the duration may fall short of that. There certainly is some case law last year that I didn't reference because I just ran into this case, a Summers versus Alterum Institute Corp., a Fourth Circuit appeals case that came down in January of last year, which is one of the first test cases testing that issue of temporary impairments and the definition of transitory and minor under the ADA. And there was a similar case in the Fifth Circuit, but under this Summers versus Alterum case, the Fourth Circuit appeals held that under the ADA Amendments Act, the gentleman's temporary impairment was sufficiently severe that it may very well be a disability, and the nature of his impairments was that he broke both legs. He had an expected prognosis of healing back to the pre-injury condition with a high likelihood of being able to return to full health within 7 to 8 months. So I think it's still an open issue somewhere between the inconvenience of a 2 or 3 day cold or a week long flu and being in a full body cast on where some injury would fall under the transitory part of that definition and exclusion. In addition, there are certain diagnoses, again, or conditions that are specifically excluded by statute. Now, we long have referred to these as the Helms Amendment, which is a little unfair to somebody that many people don't mind being unfair to, a former Senator Jesse Helms, a gentleman who's passed away a few years ago, who was a long-serving congressman and senator, who along with some other senators had some very general opposition to the Americans with Disabilities Act before its passage, and some very specific. Now, understand in this environment, we are talking about the late 80s. So, before the passage of the law, there was a multi-year effort in front of getting this in front of Congress and a multi-year effort once it was before Congress before we had a finalized ADA for then-President George H.W. Bush to sign. Helms and some other senators had some opposition to prior iterations of the proposed law. And I'm going to quote here from some legislative history. During one of the hearings where the ADA is being crafted, another senator, Senator William Armstrong, took to the Senate floor to express his opposition to the definition of disabilities that might provide protection to people with mental disorders, and this is quote, that might have a moral content to them, or in which the opinion of some people have a moral content. Similarly, another senator, Senator Warren Rudman, expressed concerns about behavior that is immoral, improper, or potentially illegal, and of which individuals are engaging of their own volition, where individuals have, at least in his perception, have control over it. It was Armstrong, in fact, that submitted most of the list of the things that people refer to as the Helms Amendment exclusions. And Senator Armstrong submitted these to then Senator Tom Harkin, who, as most of you know, was the ADA's lead drafter, one of the clearly founding fathers of the ADA. Senator Armstrong had additionally gave a list of conditions or diagnoses that he found potentially objectionable, and he cited some previous litigation under the Rehabilitation Act that listed transsexualism and transvestitism as disabilities. Now, again, I'm quoting folks here. But the vast majority of the attention, during this period of debate before the passage of the ADA, was focused on then-Senator Jesse Helms and his campaign to exclude homosexuality and bisexuality from the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was an especially charged set of circumstances, considering this is really the height of the AIDS crisis and in a period of great growth of LGBT issues and a great deal of open discrimination against the LGBT community. Now, to give Senator Helms a little credit, and I'm reluctant to do so, and I'll center myself in this debate. I'm a pink commie liberal, and I find any number of things that Helms proposed objectionable. But under this set of circumstances, he had some supporters on the left and supporters within the LGBT communities on this issue. The actual definition or the diagnosis of homosexuality as a psychiatric condition was in a period of flux during this period of debate. In fact, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, basically the tool with which most people engaged in clinical mental health in this country, had during this period of time removed the definition of homosexuality from its definitional categories in an amendment to the third version of its publication of this manual. So in the DSM-3, homosexuality was a diagnosis, and thus in the mind of Senator Helms and the other opponents to whatever, was potentially coverable under that iteration of the Americans with Disabilities Act. However, in 87 or 88, a revised version of the DSM was published, and effectively removing homosexuality as a diagnosis. And in fact, this was a version of the DSM that I used when I was in school as a social worker, or undergrad as a social worker. So again, maybe I'm giving him too much credit, and again, I'm hesitant to do so. But it was an issue. It was a hot button issue. We were certainly not as far along in the awareness of LGBT issues. And again, there was this concern that there was a moral component of potential diagnoses. And the list of specific exclusions is on the slide: homosexuality, bisexuality, transvestitism, transsexualism, pedophilia, exhibitionism, voyeurism. Genitive identity disorders, but the last several, compulsive gambling, kleptomania, pyromania, or drug addiction, are issues of very little conflict, I think. And I suspect that in granting the exclusion of these specific conditions, I'm going to go back in time and read the hearts and minds of the authors of the ADA. I suspect that this was a fairly easy notion for them to grant. It's hard to imagine a circumstance where someone would need to accommodate somebody in their compulsive gambling or kleptomania or pyromania, or would be required to do so under any legal construction. In addition, I think it was a bigger picture issue with at least a significant part of the LGBT community then pushing for moving gender identity issues and sexual orientation out of a clinical diagnostic arena as a treatable issue, then it seems somewhat forgivable that this was an issue that they conceded at the time. Now, undoubtedly, there's going to be people who disagree with that, and even I'm hesitant. But I do want to point out, that even on the issue of, even on another issue, this is still, this particular exclusion is still being fought and now as of this, I guess as of January, even litigated. There's a case in Pennsylvania of alleged workplace discrimination involving a transgendered woman named Caitlin Blatt, who claims that she was harassed by coworkers at a Pennsylvania sporting goods retailer where she used to work over 7 years ago. Last year, Blatt announced plans to file a lawsuit for discrimination in violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits sex discrimination. And in January of this year, however, she filed a lawsuit citing violations of Title II and under Title the ADA's Title I. Therefore challenging the specific exclusions of transgenderism in what I have euphemized as the Helms Amendments under the ADA. So about 50 days ago, her lawyers filed a first-of-its-kind brief that contests the constitutionality of the exclusion of the ADA's protection for people who are transgendered. Now, Attorney General Holder has 60 days from the time he received notice of the suit to respond, so you can expect sometime in the next couple weeks to perhaps see some movement on this issue. It'll be interesting for me to see how much traction she gets in the courts, but also how much backlash she may get in the blogosphere from segments of the LGBT community who have consistently in the last 20-plus years opposed the view of their statuses as something that can be considered as a treatable diagnosis. So again, there is it's to me that's an interesting tension as an outsider without this being my personal concern. So I'm enormously empathetic for an expansion of civil rights protections for people, and I'm very curious how what's going to happen as this case moves forward. But moving on, this slide and this content represents, for me, consistently, at least once every time that I do a presentation on Title I and we talk about employee count, I get the question as to why. Why is there an employee count threshold for protections under Title I of the ADA? For those of you who are not aware, in the private sector, the ADA mandates under Title II that these protections attach only to employers that have 15 or more employees. This number was established in prior employment anti-discrimination laws, specifically the Equal Employment Opportunity Act of 1972, which extended the coverage of Title VII to employers with 15 or more employees. From a previous threshold of 25 employees. So the question that I get is why 15 or why 25? Why would they? Is this an arbitrary number? And my short answer has always been it's kind of a nod at reality. And you may think of it as kind of an uncomfortable compromise. But let me back up and detail what this means. With regards to protection under the Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act, in the private sector, if you're working for an employer who only has, such as an example in this slide, 9 employees, then you would not be covered or obliged under Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So what this means is, outside of being a federal contractor or some state law that accords protections for situations or defines covered employers as employers with smaller counts than 15. And for example, I think Arkansas is 6. I believe that Minnesota is 1. But for purposes of the Americans with Disabilities Act, if you only had 9 employers or you only had 14 employees, you wouldn't be obliged under Title I of the ADA. So absent some contract provision, absent being a federal contractor or contracting with a state or local governmental entity, which had obligations to ensure that as a contractor you didn't discriminate, you could freely discriminate, and in fact some people have, under a variety of federal civil rights acts. And I say this to the point of small employers who have done things as posted sign, we would neither knowingly serve nor hire somebody with whatever status. And this has happened in the real world, and it's happened somewhat recently. So if you have 15 or more employees in the private sector, you would be obliged and your employees would be covered and protected against discrimination under Title I. So I know that seems kind of odd when you think about it, but an employer could intentionally discriminate against people with disabilities without repercussion under that circumstance, absent some contract issue or absent some state law that reduces the employee threshold count. And to give you a little bit more of a history, the threshold limit of 15 is not exactly arbitrary. The language of Title I is largely drawn from the model of the Civil Rights Act, and it's been argued in the courts many times, and it's been found defensible by a lot of judges along the ways. Now most of these decisions restate a claim that Congress intended, you know, to limit the coverage of the Civil Rights Act and later the ADA to firms with 15 or more employees in order to, you know, quote, ease their entry into the market and to preserve the competitive position of smaller firms. And also you see language such as avoiding the application of potentially crushing expense of mastering complex and complex anti-discrimination laws. Now these aren't my words, folks. However, I think it's a legally defensible argument. But, you know, for example, they could have just as easily established a tenure or an income limit, you know, the amount of financial resources an employee may have or how long they've been in business. But I think from a statutory construction and an enforcement perspective, the employee threshold limit is just easier to make it work. So, you know, such analysis is a lot easier than examining requiring the examination of an employer's financial books or just trying to calculate how long it's been in business as that exact business entity. But just to understand that, particularly the advocates out there, if you're talking to somebody about their employment situation, it is important to ask how many coworkers that they have, how many employees that their employer does has hired, and so it may in fact help them to direct their claim, any complaint that they have, any claim that they may raise to the EEOC or alternatively to a state employment or labor authority in order to bring a claim where the state law reduces the threshold to a lesser number. Okay, what about with regards to Title II entities? Now we're using the shortcut, but what about employee count and the threshold when we're talking about employees of state and local governmental entities? Seen in this picture is, and I love this story, a very cute human interest story I came across. This was last year, Mayor Paul Gilliland of Harrington, Washington. This is a small town in south central Washington, I think, with a population of 420 people. Mayor Gilliland backs up the fire chief, Scott McGowan, on wastewater treatment. You can see him working on a pipe here, among other things. And according to the city clerk, who's also the lead historian of the local preservation and historical society, who's also the webmaster and who also seems to do pretty much everything else in terms of official city function, and her name, by the way, very nice, very helpful lady by the name of Loretta Bunny Haugen. She detailed that there are 3 full-time town employees and 4 part-time city employees, and that for the rest of its governmental functions, the city contracts with the county. So the question is, Is Mayor Paul Gillian, is the lovely Loretta Bunny Haugen protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act? And the answer is you can find in section 35.140 of Title II of the ADA, which states that no qualified individual with a disability shall, on the basis of their disability, be subjected to discrimination in employment under a service program or activities conducted by a public entity. And for purposes of this part, the requirements of Title I of the ADA shall apply to employment in any service program or activities conducted by a public entity if that public entity is also subject to the jurisdiction under Title I, which, as I've been led to believe, is talking about the employee count threshold. But also, in part subpart 2, for purposes of this part, the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and its employment protections there apply to employment in any service program or activities conducted by a public entity if that public entity is not also subject to the jurisdictions of Title I. So under these circumstances, these very small public entities, the city of Harrington, Washington, these employees, which include Mayor Gillian and the lovely Ms. Haugen, would not be protected under Title I of the ADA, but would be protected under similar employment provisions of the Rehabilitation Act. And the city of Harrington would be prohibited against discrimination on the basis of disability and other protective statuses. So does the ADA apply to the federal government? And the short answer to that is no, but with one large exception, Congress. And I'm not going to spend too much time on this issue, but I kind of want to give a little bit of background. The ADA does cover Congress because it was politically expedient to do so. You may remember the debate in front of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, what is euphemistically known as Obamacare, where there was a great deal of political traction behind the notion that why should we vote to pass something that doesn't even apply to the proponents of the law, when in fact it either wasn't relevant or it did apply. And in fact, I do believe there was a member of the minority House that stated that actually proposed that they that put forth an amendment to make sure that this applies to Congress unnecessarily, but because it was politically expedient to do so. And this is to a certain extent the same thing. The Congress and in fact all federal agencies are covered under the predecessor to the ADA, the Rehabilitation Act. This application doesn't significantly change the obligations of the Congress or the rights of the employees of Congress with regards to workplace discrimination protections, but it does make a palatable, politically expedient concession that may have in fact influenced some lawmakers to vote for the law. But it's not just an incidental application. It's not just the members of the Senate and the House. It does apply more broadly to the instrumentalities of Congress, which do represent at least a couple of thousand additional employees on top of the Congress people themselves and their staffs, because it also covers the General Accounting Office, the Architect of the Capitol, as you see here, the Government Printing Office, and the Library of Congress, not inconsequential legislative instrumentalities or legislative bodies. So moving forward, what about other ADA boundaries? Where are we on the, stretching the envelope of the ADA? An issue that rarely comes up in litigation but does come up is the application of civil rights and generally in the ADA specifically with regards to American Indian and Alaska Native tribes. And just to give you some perspective, As of 2013, the count from the Bureau of Indian Affairs are that there are 566 Native American and Alaskan Native tribes that have been recognized by their by the agency. So this is 566 independent, sovereign political bodies that are contained within the United States. And this has some implications for the application of the ADA and other civil rights laws in that context. So let's kind of examine it title by title. And I do want to thank the Tulalip tribe for the use of their symbol of this lovely orca. I did use that without permission. I hope that I don't offend anybody within that tribe, but I've always found it to be a compelling image. So again, let's move through this discussion fairly quickly and go title by title. Under Title I of the ADA, it, quote, specifically excludes Indian tribe, quote, Indian tribe from the definition of an employer under the law. So any employment discrimination suit against a tribe or its officials under Title I would be undoubtedly dismissed for lack of a subject matter jurisdiction because of its specific exclusion under the definition. What about Title II? Title II regulates state and local governmental entities, but it makes no specific mention of, again, quote, Indian tribes when it's defining public entities. Since Title II clearly defines its applicability, you know, to the programs and services and any activities that are run by state and local governmental entities, you know, by legal construction, Title II would probably not apply to parallel programs and services that are run by tribal government. So I'm going to give a big X to Title II and its coverage. What about Title III? Well, Title III complicates things. There's one federal appellate court that ruled that Title III can apply to places of public accommodation. Again, these are businesses and commercial facilities that are open to the public and under these circumstances operated by quote, Indian tribes. The citation is, for those who are interested, it's Florida Paraplegic Association versus the, and I may be mispronouncing this, the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida. It's a 1999 case out of the 11th Circuit. In addition, this is in contrast to some other decisions, such as the Donovan versus the Coeur d'Alene Tribal Farm case, which is a much earlier case out of the Ninth Circuit, 1985 case, which essentially restated the notion of sovereign immunity, where the tribal governments act as independent governments with a limited amount of self-control under treaty. They are protected from interference with the rights to self-government. So again, there appears to be a conflict in the circuits, where the 11th Circuit is under Donovan versus Coeur d'Alene Tribal Farm is claiming that this wasn't this does contradict congressional intent, the lower court, and that the tribal-run business does not fall under regulation in interstate commerce, as opposed to the, again, the 11th Circuit case of 1999, the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida. Sorting through this analysis, and I'm kind of waffling here, this is a really complex law. Congress did not express their intention to waive tribal sovereign immunity anywhere in the ADA. So if you're going to enforce the provisions of protections against discrimination in places of public accommodations, or what would be that, as operated by tribal governments, the intervention, the litigation would have to be initiated by the federal government. It seems abundantly clear in that kind of Title III arena that outside the 11th Circuit, it seems unlikely that you would be successful bringing the case as a private individual or a state and local governmental entity. And this has been recently reinforced under a, let's see, let me get forward in my notes here, under the Bay Mills case, Michigan versus Bay Mills Indian Community, which is not a case involving civil rights, but last year there was an appeal before the U.S. Supreme Court that dealt with the efforts of the state of Michigan to bring a suit to enforce limitations on casino gambling and pari-mutuel bettings. And here the tribe had, this wasn't about gaming on the tribal on tribal lands. This here the tribe had bought land and opened a casino that was off tribal lands. And the decision was handed down by a divided Supreme Court, but this time it wasn't divided along partisan lines. And they denied Michigan's appeal and reaffirmed the lower appellate court. The court decided 5-4 that Michigan's lawsuit seeking to block their establishment of a casino on non-Indian lands was barred by sovereign immunity. The court concluded, and this is interesting, and that unless Congress had specifically authorized the lawsuit, that it must be dismissed. The court agreed that with the state that the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act partially allowed them to abrogate sovereign immunity by allowing them to enjoy some activity, gaming activity on tribal lands, but the act specifically didn't come into play here because of the absence of language dealing with gaming off of tribal lands. And it's an interesting kind of catch-22 or an anomaly, which essentially Michigan would be able to regulate at least somewhat the gaming occurring within the confines of tribal, identified tribal lands, but on land off the outside the tribal lands that owned by the tribe, they were barred from bringing lawsuit based on sovereign immunity. And so while acknowledging that this was a confusing catch-22-like situation, the court indicated clearly that it's a court and they don't revise legislation, even where, you know, where this weird situation was created. So I think this illustrates the power of sovereign immunity and somewhat the complexity of civil rights in tribal context. It seems likely to me that no lawsuit would gain, you know, traction to impose the requirements of Title III of the ADA on tribal-run businesses outside the 11th Circuit, absent an amendment to the ADA or action by the federal government. Okay, ramping up and getting to, I want to allow as time for as much many questions as possible. So I'm going to kind of get through the rest of this material with some rapidity. What about the ADA and private clubs? And by private clubs, I mean private clubs. There is an exception to ADA coverage, ADA coverage under Title III, excluding truly private, bona fide private clubs from obligations under Title III. Now, what are these? What are bona fide private clubs? Now, I do provide in the handout or the downloadable handout a link to, I think, what I've seen is the best short overview of the of what bona fide private clubs are in this exception. It's authored by a an attorney and a consultant, and not the federal government. But it seems spot on legally, and it's concise and clear and fairly plain language. I encourage you, if you have this as an issue or you're curious, to please download that and click on that link. And read that very excellent, enviably good short article on the private club exceptions. So there is a carve out for private clubs, but what is a private club? Well, any number of private clubs have asserted exemption from obligations under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and Title III of the ADA for a variety of things. There have been country clubs accused of excluding people from enjoying their facilities based on race. There has been other clubs that have sought to exclude themselves from application of what they perceive as these onerous obligations. But the issue is are they truly a private club? Do they exist only to benefit its members, or do they or is membership more a formality? So, for example, I'll use this. I lived in the Panhandle of Texas in a dry county. A dry county is a county where they've elected, despite state law allowing generally bottle and by serving liquor sales, this county had excluded it. However, there was a under the local ordinance, there was an exclusion for private clubs, and private club membership was defined as filling out an application, paying $3, and getting a card. Inarguably, that would fail the test of a bona fide private club for a variety of reasons, and as much as every single one of these was available to anybody on a moment's notice, it engaged in the kind of commerce typical of a tavern. It didn't exist for the sole purpose of benefiting its members exactly, but this gets a little more complicated when you talk about other club setups. So what would you say a private club is? Is a country club a private club? It may be. Is a fraternal organization a private club? It may be. The Order of the Eastern Star, the Ku Klux Klan, the Lions, the Elks, your local country club may be bona fide private clubs and eligible for exception under the obligations under Title III, but it's going to depend on how they're controlled and how the facilities are used in terms of its application. So clearly, if you have a facility that holds itself out as a destination, as an event center, particularly for weddings, such as the Rainier Club here in Seattle, which is a vaunted private club, but nevertheless is a choice and expensive and elegant location for a wedding, and they do a great deal of business that way, offering not only the rental of the halls, but the management of catering, the event planning, etc. And so, to the extent that it functions as a site for wedding, it is going to most likely be considered a place of public accommodation under Title III, unless these benefits were limited to members only, in which case, in case of the Rainier Club, that's certainly not the case. The Benevolent Fraternal Order of the Elks may in fact be a bona fide private club and do all sorts of admirable things, including raise money through a variety of fundraisers, such as, typically in the South, we'll see them sponsoring a lot of bingo for fundraisers. But to the extent that they're opening themselves up to the public to provide the opportunity to play bingo for a fee, they would probably fall outside the bona fide private club exception on the Americans with Disabilities Act. So what about churches? Section 307 of the ADA provides that the provisions of the title shall not apply to religious organizations or entities controlled by religious organizations, including places of worship. So with regards to Title III, it seems clear that that Congress intended, wrote into the law, broad and deep exclusions for coverage of religious organizations, including the activities of religious organizations in a wide array of situations, when they're conducting activities that would otherwise make it a public accommodation, they would be exempt from the ADA coverage. And with regards to the design and construction elements of churches, limiting limiting their requirement that they provide reasonable accommodation to allow someone to enjoy their facilities. Now understand, there's kind of two exceptions to this. While the ADA does not impose the design and construction or the ADA standards as an obligation for churches built or altered since the effective date of that law, state and local building codes or accessibility code may mandate at least some consideration be made with regards to meeting the needs of people with disabilities to enter, exit, and conduct business within those facilities. However, using the Texas Architectural Barriers Act as an example, very, very broadly, the Texas accessibility standards would apply to the construction or new alteration of a church facility, and would basically get you into the church and throughout the church building until you entered the place of worship, in which case the obligation would end. Okay, but also note that where a church may donate space to, say, a community theater, that community theater might be obliged, might be treated as a public accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act, where it was independently leasing the space and then selling tickets to the public. It's an interesting notion. If a church contracted with the county government, say, to provide adult daycare for senior citizens who are in need of that service, the church itself might be exempt from coverage under Title III of the ADA, but the county would be obliged to ensure that service that they were contracting would be accessible to and usable by people with disabilities under its obligations under Title II. So it's an interesting construction, but I think you can broadly say that churches have a great deal of exempted protection from obligation under the ADA. So what about employment and the ADA? Are churches subject to the employment provisions of the ADA? In most circumstances, the answer is yes if they are otherwise covered under the jurisdiction of the ADA. So if they meet the 15 or more employee threshold, they are usually subject to protections and obligations under Title I of the ADA. However, there is a specific exception for clerical staff or ministers. So your pastor, your imam, your rabbi, your other religious leader is clearly exempted. And this is a nod towards allowing churches, the separation of church and state, and to limit the kind of intrusion on how an organization would define its leadership, the role of its ministers, and to free them from this obligation that would otherwise have the federal government potentially limiting their ability to define the nature of what they believe and what they practice and preach. However, this was an issue that was tested in a couple years ago in a case that I believe that I cite in the handout, Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School versus the EEOC. The Supreme Court held towards the end of 2012 in a unanimous, a 9-0 verdict, and it's weird to see, again, a divided and partisan Supreme Court held unanimously in favor of the church, indicating that the First Amendment granted the First Amendment reads through and they granted a recognition of the ministerial exception from the application of the discrimination provisions of the ADA. Now, the interesting thing is this. The facts muddy up the decision. It seems, I think few people would disagree that if we, in fact, are a nation that recognizes that we need to separate the church and the state and not interfere with the religious practices of individuals in a legitimate and recognized religion, I think most people can agree on that. I'm not saying everybody. But the facts do muddy, you know, muddy this water a little bit. Under this circumstance, the Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Church is a religious corporation that's affiliated with the Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which is perceived to be a little more conservative than I guess the more general Lutheran Church. Cheryl Parrish, who's seen in this photo here, was what they called a called teacher in the Hosanna Tabor Church School. As such, she had completed a course of study that included classes required by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and she had received a certificate for admission into the teaching ministry along with her other teaching credentials. Ms. Parrish was called, and she was hired as a teacher. Her teaching duties were identical to those other teachers who were considered contract lay teachers who did not meet the LCMS teaching ministry requirements. So she worked side by side with educators similarly with similar tasks who weren't called teachers. And the evidence indicates that Hosanna Tabor did not require teachers to be called or even to be Lutheran to teach at the school. It also indicated that non-Lutheran teachers, again, had the identical responsibilities to the Lutheran teachers, including teaching religion classes and even leading chapel. In June of 2004, Parrish became ill. She was hospitalized. In the fall of 2004, the administrators of the school suggested that she take disability leave. And the principal assured her that she'd still have a job when she regained health. Parrish wrote the school in 2005 advising the school that she would be able to return to work in February. However, Hosanna Tabor refused to allow her to return to work and asked her to resign her call. When she refused to do so and filed a charge of discrimination and retaliation, the congregation voted to rescind her call and notified her that she was fired. It's an interesting set of circumstances. While there were certainly people besides the nine justices of the Supreme Court who disagreed with the decision, and point to the facts that say essentially this teacher was discriminated against on the basis of her disability, and that should be unlawful. The holding says that doesn't make a determination whether she discriminated or not. It was that they were free to make. Is that the church leaders were free to make that decision because of the ministerial exception, whether or not she was discriminated against unlawfully, whether or not she was a person with a disability or not. So those are findings that they didn't even have to reach. Now the fear is from the people who opposed the unanimous verdict would be that you would start seeing church employers. Choosing to define more and more of its employees as having a ministerial role or making them something like called teachers, but also called account managers and called customer service staff and called custodians. I would hope that you wouldn't be seeing that moving forward, but given the realities of our litigious nature, I suspect that we will see at least a case or two moving forward where you see someone who falls outside of the perceived ministerial role having to assert that they are not, in fact, a minister as understood under the ministerial exception. But that's speculation. What about the ADA and affirmative action? I can answer this fairly quickly. There is no affirmative action component of the Americans with Disabilities Act. There's a great deal of misunderstanding about what affirmative action is generally. I encourage, again, any listeners who would like to have some of their illusions disabused to check out the link that I provide, on guidance from the EEOC on affirmative action. I believe it's the seventh citation. There's a couple of good points to be made, to be drawn from the EEOC's, the ADA, your responsibilities as an employer, and also a non-federal and non-ADA center publication, but a very good one, written by the ACLU, Myths and Facts About Affirmative Action. I would encourage, again, anybody who's particularly interested in this subtopic to move forward and read those. Okay, so what about the geography and the limits of the ADA? You know, now that we've ran through these issues of legal construction, what about the actual borders? What about this geography? Well, this is actually the issue that got me interested in this topic. I think it was 10 years ago, maybe more, when I was attending this continuing education being offered by this Houston attorney, the issue of, I asked the simple question is, what are the geographic limits of the United States? And the answer is the United States, and then the answer is the United States and the U.S. territories, and the U.S. territories and the U.S. protectorates and the minor outlying islands. In fact, any of you who may be registering for something online may see a drop-down menu asking where you're from, and you may be troubled by the notion that you have to, you can't just easily push you. You're going to end up with Uganda, United States, but also United States territories and outlying minor islands. So just looking at this map, again, clearly if you're another sovereign country, any country in South America or Africa or Asia or Europe, any country in North America that's not the United States, so Mexico and Canada, and Greenland, are not the United States or America as we think of it. Clearly the lower 48, Hawaii and Alaska, are the United States. I think few people would disagree that the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, major U.S. territories that most of us are familiar with, are also the United States, or territories of the United States, but these also include places I've never heard of before I asked this question. Now, when I started asking this question, I think in 2004, 2005, I contacted the State Department and asked for a complete list of all U.S. territories and protectorates and what have you political bodies controlled by the United States. And they were unable to provide the list. As the internet advances, as Wikipedia kind of organically grew out there, and as the federal government got really good about moving its content online, we do have this answer more completely. But understand, if it's marked up there and it doesn't have an X on it, it's probably America as defined under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act and other civil rights laws, and also, for example, occupational health and safety laws would also extend to places such as the Northern Mariana Islands, Wake Island, and various other Pacific islands that are within U.S. territories as we've come to understand them. What about America and the ADA? And I swear I've got this question. What about Antarctica? Well, I had to ask that question. I had assumed that someone had laid claim to Antarctica, so does anybody own it? And it really does depend on who you ask. There are seven nations who have made or are currently making territorial claims to Antarctica, but the United States is not one of them. I know this isn't going to come up in any of your work, but it's an interesting intellectual exercise to me. So while the United States doesn't lay claim to Antarctica, we do have research a presence there. We have a business presence there. It may be of growing importance in terms of climate research, any number of scientific and potential commercial issues that may flow from our presence there. But and our presence is there through a variety of treaties, but it's the official position of our country, the United States, that no one owns Antarctica, despite the seven other sovereign nations indicating that they have some ownership right to all or part of Antarctica. But the U.S. indicates that no one owns it, no one can. And it's pretty nice of us, I think, actually, to just kind of unilaterally exclude anyone's claim. So there's little need to discuss it in terms of the civil rights framework as yet, but I think it's an interesting notion when you're trying to define the confines of the U.S. for purposes of application of federal law. So what about the moon? I know it's silly, but it is an unanswered question. But there are treaties that are in effect about the moon and about a territoriality, about ownership or territorial claims to the moon. The interesting thing is, though, despite the fact that there are international treaties in effect, none of the countries that actually go into space are signatories to that treaty. So while the U.S. hasn't exactly claimed the moon as territory, it is beginning to encourage commercial development. I found this fairly interesting. The FAA has begun to consider it necessary to discuss regulations for that development. And so for the truly nerdy that are out there, there is an article link in the download. And while I suspect the moon won't need any lawyers anytime soon, during my lifetime, at some point someone may be plying their trade and bringing ADA cases on the moon. I sure hope so. Well, no. Let me back that up. I hope that we solve discrimination by the time we colonize the moon enough to exert civil rights protections there. But if we haven't, I hope that someone's up there extending the protections of the Constitution to the people who live there. What about ADA and employment protections under Title I overseas? Congress actually, in 1991, Congress amended the Civil Rights Act in response to a case. It was Borsalain versus Ramco. I'm not sure whether I cited that in your handout. This was a case involving a U.S. company that was based in Delaware and it was doing business in the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. It did not involve an ADA case, but Congress amended Section 109 of the Civil Rights Act. And that, by construction, amended both Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act to add the definition of an employee, which includes, quote, with respect to employment in a foreign country, an individual who is a citizen of the United States shall be protected against discrimination against U.S. citizens abroad, and they will be covered if they are engaged by an American employer or by a foreign corporation controlled by an American employer. So this new section of the ADA makes it clear that while this it will cover employees under those circumstances, it will not apply to foreign operations of an employer that is a foreign person not controlled by an American employer. So essentially, if you're working overseas for an American corporation, here the photo, I believe it's of the large, fairly new Microsoft campus, and I think this is their Dubai headquarter. Those employees who are employed by the U.S.-based division of Microsoft to work overseas temporary or in long-term placement in Dubai would be protected under various federal civil rights, including Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Okay, I think we're a little bit out of order here, but that's okay. So the ADA doesn't exactly stop or at our border, it does depend on the specifics of the circumstances and the specific construction of the law. So what about the ADA and international air carriers, or what about the ADA and air carriers generally? The Americans with Disabilities Act does not extend to commercial passenger airlines when they are acting as commercial air carriers, either domestic or international. However, so that's a big no. However, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Air Carrier Access Act, the ACAA, is a law that does protect passengers from discrimination, and it requires that air carriers do certain things with regards to accommodating passengers with disabilities and issues relating to the even the airframe itself, the aircraft itself, over a certain size. So there are regulations that actually dictate some of the engineering and accord some protections. But more generally, the Air Carrier, and the Air Carrier Access Act was passed in 1986, so it was 4 years before the ADA. And it doesn't provide, as wide of protections as the ADA, but it does offer some very specific protection for those passengers, airline passengers with disabilities. But most generally, the Air Carrier Access Act prohibits U.S. and foreign carriers from discriminating against passengers on the basis of disabilities, and it does require those carriers to make aircraft and other facilities and certain services accessible to people with disabilities, and dictates that they must have policies in place so that they can take steps to accommodate passengers with a variety of disabilities. So the answer is, does the ADA extend? No, but there are some protections. What about the ADA and foreign flag passenger vessels? Now, I need to make this clear. It should be clear that the ADA does cover domestic passenger vessels, such as passenger and car ferries, such as sightseeing and gambling boats. However, all passenger cruise ships, all of them, that to my knowledge and the industry's knowledge, are what they call foreign flagged. And by this means, by this I mean that they are flying the flag of a foreign country. This is kind of endemic in the maritime reality. Most vessels are not going to be flagged in major in their country of origin as we might think of it. And most passenger vessels, large ocean-going passenger vessels or cargo vessels, fly what they call a flag of convenience. So there is, to my knowledge and all the research that I did within the industry publications, there's not a single cruise ship that's flying an American flag. The vessel that you see here is actually the Norwegian Star. It's one of the larger ships in the Norwegian cruise lines. I believe I referenced the case. It's a Spectre versus Norwegian Cruise Lines. It's a 2005 Supreme Court case. And let me put it this way. The ADA does cover foreign flag passenger vessels. Supreme Court case, essentially, is the plaintiffs were mostly U.S. residents. There are a number of plaintiffs besides Spectre. They're all individuals with disabilities. They all published tickets from Norwegian Cruise Line in 1998 or 99 for round-trip cruises that originated in the United States and returned to the United States on Norwegian Cruise Line's cruise ships, the Norwegian Sea and the Norwegian Star. Both of those cruise ships fly foreign flags. The plaintiffs contended that there were physical barriers aboard the ship that violated Title III, and that there were other various failures of reasonable modifications of policies and practices that presented additional barriers on top of the structural barriers. The initial trial court dismissed the Title III claims. The Fifth Circuit affirmed the lower court, holding that the ADA was inapplicable to foreign vessels because it found no indication that Congress specifically intended Title III to apply to foreign flag cruise ships. But the Supreme Court disagreed, and Justice Kennedy wrote the majority, stating that it met the definition of public accommodation and specified public transportation. And while it didn't expressly mention cruise ship, that there could be no serious doubt that the Norwegian Cruise Line cruise ships did fall within both of those definitions under any conventional principles of interpretation. Undoubtedly, the cruise line and its attorneys disagreed with that, but the majority, again, found that this was applicable However, there was a limitation in application. There would be no obligation to accommodate under the meaning of Title III, where such accommodations, such as a modification of policy or practice, would interfere with the reasonable governance of the ship, or something that would interfere with the way that someone sailed the ship, managed the crew of the ship. So the takeaway from this is that Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act is applicable to foreign flag ships, unless somehow that was going to interfere with or disrupt the ship's internal affairs. So again, just think of it as a yes. Now we've reached the end of my part of this. Again, I want to encourage you to ask some questions, and we'll stay around as long as Marissa lets us. As I said at the beginning or towards the beginning, I don't think you're not to blame for the failures of the ADA. As a person with rights or an advocate, you're not blamed for failing to realize all the potential of the Americans with Disabilities Act. As somebody who works for an entity that is obliged under the Americans with Disabilities Act, you're not responsible for every failure in the past 25 years. So I forgive you, but moving forward, you are now responsible for at least this information. I encourage you to hang around and ask some questions, and I'll hand it over to Marissa for that purpose.
Thanks, Aaron. Yes, we've got a bunch of questions that came in. Just a quick reminder to everyone, if you have a question, you can type it in there in the chat box area. I'm going to start with a question that just came in because we were talking about the cruise liners. This person's asking, this says, the Norwegian cruise line vessels in Hawaiian Islands are American flag vessels. So would that, I mean, does that mean they would apply?
Well, yes. As I think I made clear, I was unaware that there were, and perhaps they offer, perhaps they're talking about inter-island cruises. And I think clearly, I know clearly those would be covered. And we spent more time on the foreign flagged aspect of it, but I think it's an interesting point of law. So yes, short answer.
Okay, thanks, Aaron. Okay, next question is, aren't we expected to accommodate people with temporary impairments at temporary events that are open to the public? For instance, allowing the use of a raised viewing platform if someone has a broken leg. Now, would they be justified in requesting a doctor's note for someone who claims to have a temporary disability? For example, sometimes people who have a mobility impairment, maybe they come with an ACE bandage, et cetera.
Well, and I think this is an effort to find an easier way to discriminate. I suspect the question's looking at the fact that people do abuse, particularly like ticketing for events. I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind that there are people who would utilize a claim of disability or at least a claim of impairment in disability-ish to secure better tickets to a concert or, let's say, the division finals of a professional sports team. The issue is in practice, in respecting the guidance from the Department of Justice, if in fact you would notice abuse over time, that might be something that you could explore. But during the transaction where someone's booking and requesting accommodated seating, accessible seating, or when they show up with a ticket without that advanced discussion, in all practicality, how could you expect the people who are taking your tickets, who may not even be your employees, who may be contracted by a management company at the venue or by the artist or the talent themselves. So can you ask for that? Under most circumstances, I would say no, it would be considered unduly burdensome. People with disabilities are not required to carry around documentation of their disability. The Title I issue is an exception. The employment setting is a slightly different set of circumstances, but I would say no. I would say that would tend to discriminate against people with disabilities and create a burden that might open you up to some liability. Next question.
Great. Can you talk a bit about the illegal drug use exception and how that came about and how you're seeing it used?
Well, I probably should have. This is an omission, so thank you for catching me. I probably should have did this. I know that this is content that's dealt with quite a bit when we're in other ADA trainings, and there's some very excellent Title I ADA trainings that are archived in the ADA Legal series that deal with this in detail. But essentially, you're not, despite the fact that you may be diagnosed, you may be significantly impaired by your drug use, you're not protected against discrimination when you're actively abusing drugs, despite the fact that you may have a diagnosable and treatable condition, despite the fact that you might, in fact, be defined as disabled under some other scheme of disability, such as Social Security disability, military impairment, I don't know, service-related injury, be a little bit of a stretch with a drug abuse problem. But the protections of the ADA does not accord to somebody who's actively using illegal drugs, and that means actively using illegal drugs. So a history of having used drugs is a status where you may be accorded protection under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Drinking alcohol is certainly a different issue. It's a whole other kettle of fish, but it's a lawful activity. Abusing prescription drugs in an illegal manner or abusing so-called street drugs creates a status where you wouldn't be protected under the ADA. And it's intentional. It's basically one of those kind of moral exceptions that was carved out to placate any number of legislators who felt that the earlier iterations of the ADA during the legislative process were too broad and too permissive. Next question.
Okay. They're asking you to clarify in terms of discrimination of Native American tribes. Is it the applicant for a job in a tribal business that is not covered, or is it Native Americans who are not covered when applying, not in tribal-run businesses? Does that make sense?
No, not really. I'm not sure. I'll try to address it. I'm not sure I'm understanding the question, but if we're talking about an entity that's not ran by the tribe, owned by or ran by the tribal government, then you can't assert tribal sovereign immunity. So that may answer the question. So we are talking about tribal governmental action, tribal governmental businesses, tribal governmental programs and services. So if we're talking about somebody who happens to be a member of a tribe who happens to have a business where they hire employees, then you would just look to other construction issues. Do they have 15 or more employees? Are they otherwise obliged under Title I of the ADA and other similar civil rights laws? I think that may answer the question. I hope it does. If not, send me an email. Next question. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, I can now.
Sorry. Sorry. Okay, next question is, how does ADA apply to fraternities or sororities, private social clubs on campuses?
Well, again, to the extent that they're bona fide private clubs, they would be excluded from coverage under the ADA, to the extent that they're acting as bona fide private clubs. Where they might function, where they might host a temporary event that's open to general admission, then that function would probably open them up to be considered, at least arguably open them up to be considered a public accommodation. But with regards to their the particulars of their membership, they can be discriminatory as they like. As we have seen with recent action, however, their charters are generally subject to the will of the institution of which they are affiliated, and so discriminatory activity may in fact result in them losing their charter and essentially being disbanded at the institution that perceives that slight as against the mission of that institution. And I'm trying not to be specific, University of Oklahoma, but yeah, it's you. Next question.
Okay, one last question. We're going to give you a little bit of a scenario talking about companies operating on foreign soils. If a bus company, say, that travels from destinations to and from U.S. to Mexico, if the company provides, say, aid to a person boarding or deboarding the bus, would that still apply once they get to the foreign country? So would they still have to, would ADA still apply in terms of them providing aid to that person to deboard or board the bus?
Well, it's an interesting issue. There are a number of bus lines that serve all over the country where a passenger is picked up. So at least a passenger's ride begins in the United States and ends in another country. I mean, we are talking about Canada or Mexico, and a significant amount of bus companies serving southern states, and particularly Texas and Arizona and California, where, again, they're picking up in destinations in, say, San Antonio, and then delivering somebody over the border in Nuevo Laredo or deeper into the interior of Mexico, most commonly. They are obliged under the Americans with Disabilities Act in their actions on this side of the border, and then their selection of their vehicles, their bus fleet. They, as any over-the-road bus company, would be obliged under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And in fact, in I think it was 2010-2011, maybe slightly earlier, the Department of Justice pursued, I think, almost 10, you know, mid-size to fairly large passenger bus carriers that, again, had business that originated in the United States, or at least would take tickets that would originate in the United States and then travel over the border. And there were any number of complaints, and they so they pursued these companies, and they settled with quite a few of them in 2009-2010. We read quite a few of those settlements. Department of Justice made it clear that that they had obligations to modify their policies and practices to accommodate the needs of people with disabilities, and to ensure that their vehicles, their bus fleet, was in fact updated and up to the Department of Transportation's accessibility standards for passenger buses, over-the-road passenger buses. As to the specifics, once you cross the border, there are certain things. The reality of it is it may be out of the control of the bus company. Just like in domestic carriers in the United States, any number of people are picked up in locations and dropped off in locations that aren't ran by or managed by the bus companies. And as a nod to reality, none of the settlement agreements dictated that that these bus companies try to enforce U.S. law in another country, but they had to go. They had to endeavor to help to the extent feasible. They had to do some. They had to train their staff to understand the obligations of the law, and they had. And there was suggestions during the negotiations for the settlements that they do. That they provide some information up front to passengers who identify as people with disabilities, who would be in need of this assistance, about what their expectations would be once they cross the border. So managing some expectations so that people could make informed decisions about whether their level of accessibility needs could be met at the other end, or whether or not they would need to ensure that there was assistance at the other end. Next question.
Okay, well, we are out of time. I know that there's some questions we did not get to, but Aaron, if you're willing, what we could do is send those questions to you, and then we could post the answers later on with the archive file, if that's okay with you.
No, absolutely. And again, my apologies. I ran over long. I practiced this, and it went a lot faster when the pressure was off. So I'll take it upon myself to answer every question to the best of my ability, or refer somebody appropriately. So if there are a host of unanswered questions out there, please do what Marissa says, submit those, and I'll make sure that I get after them as quickly as possible. And again, thank you for your time, Marissa, and for the listeners out there. And I guess my part of this is at a close.
Thanks again, Aaron. Again, this concludes today's webinar. We realize that you may still have questions for Aaron, and we apologize if we didn't get a chance to ask your question. But what you can do is if you have a question that we didn't get to, you can email it to the Southwest ADA Center at swdbtac@ilru.org. And again, we can provide those answers a little bit later. Again, we want to thank Aaron for sharing his time and awesome expertise with us today. I know we ran a little bit over, so we certainly appreciate everybody sticking around. We certainly learned a lot from you today, Aaron. And again, a last reminder that today's session was recorded, and it will be available for viewing within about 24 hours. That's going to be available at www.ada-audio.org. And again, lastly, we invite you to join us for the next scheduled session of the Legal Webinar Series, which is going to be held on July 15, 2015, as they discuss the most important cases since the ADA was passed 25 years ago. You can find out more about that or register for that upcoming webinar, again, at www.ada-audio.org. For questions regarding this or other sessions in the series, you can direct those to 877-232-1990 or via email to webinars@ada-audio.org. And lastly, thank you for doing that slide up, Janet. You're going to receive the link to the evaluation today via email at the conclusion of our program, as well as instructions regarding securing certificates of attendance or other continuing education recognition. We encourage you to participate and share your views with us, as they're always valued. Again, thank you, Aaron, and thank you to the staff at Great Lakes and everybody for joining us today. You may now disconnect from your browser.
Conference recording stopped.